Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Might be a bit of a long episode today because I was just thinking, oh, it's pretty late, it's 1 a.m. I hope today's chapter is short. I don't usually hope that it's short, but in this case I was like, I'm just going to have a quick scroll through and see how long this chapter goes for. 19 pages, it's the longest one yet. So, be careful what you wish for, hey? Today we'll be discussing Story 7, The Two Gallants, and then we'll be reading Story 8, which is called A Little Cloud. The questions that I asked the subreddit were these. What's Doran going to do? Do you think he loves her? Did anyone else find this story easier to follow and interpret? And there was a curious moment where it detailed how he moved away from religion in his 20s in order to impress girls, potentially, and then back to it in his 30s. What do you make of that? First up, Techrific came in again with the vocabulary. Really helpful. Thanks, Tech. So here are some definitions of the more obscure words from this story. Take the pledge means take an oath not to consume alcohol. Sheriff's man is a revenue and debt collector. Favorites and outsiders, likely and less likely winners in a horse race. Handy with the mitts is slang for a good fighter. Corn factors, an agent for the sale of corn. Short 12 is noon mass. Sit is a bit of slang, which is short for situation. Screw is British slang for salary. Pier glass is a tall mirror set in the section, pier, between windows. Reynolds newspaper is a London newspaper that reported on scandalous events. A certain fame means a bad reputation. A combing jacket is a bathrobe, and return room is a room, usually small, added to the wall of a house. Awesome stuff. Techrific also said, regarding the third question about him moving away from religion and then back into it, well, I don't think his lack of religion was the thing that impressed the girls. I got the sense that he relaxed his morals in order to seduce the girls, then tried to become more moral and upstanding in his 30s. Since he's working for a Catholic organization, it stems to reason he'd have to behave appropriately lest he put his position and social standing in jeopardy. Regarding the question, what is Doran going to do? Techrific said, I don't think this was ambiguous at all. Her mother called Polly down to have a talk with Doran. Unless he wants to disgrace himself publicly, he'd have to propose to Polly. He would have run away without talking if that was his intention. I think he reluctantly accepted his fate, but regretted his adventure with Polly. He's afraid of the volatile brother, too, who's demonstrably handy with the mitts. I really like this story. It was well constructed, followed the same themes as the previous ones, but I didn't mind so much. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, I don't think he was much of a seducer or relaxed his morals. It was not altogether his fault that it happened. He remembered well, with the curious, patient memory of the celibate, the first casual caress of her dress, her breath, her fingers had given him. Then late one night, as he was undressing for bed, she tapped at his door timidly. The instinct of the celibate warned him to hold back, but the sin was there. Even his sense of honour told him reparations must be made for such a sin. Girls a century were not singing, I'm a naughty girl, flirting openly and brazenly, and knocking on men's doors. Mothers did not stand by. Polly knew she was being watched, but still her mother's persistence, silence, could not be misunderstood. At last, when she determined it was the right moment, Mrs. Mooney intervened. The decisive nature of her grand florid face satisfied her, and she thought of some mothers she knew who could not get their daughters off their hands. I don't think he was a seducer. As the boarder says, he suspected he was being had. I agree, I quite like him for these lines. He could not make up his mind whether to like her or despise her for what she had done. Of course, he had done it too. Techrific responded, saying, well, what I meant was, since we're talking about a repressed Catholic, his moving away from religion was a mental thing or a trick in order to overcome his guilt for thinking about seduction, girls, and sex. In all honesty, I think you're right that he wasn't much of a seducer, but that this was a psychological shift in his mind. The irony of it is that he had moved back into the fold, so to speak, when the deed with Polly happened. Jordanzi said, "It's interesting that all Duran gets from Jack is a cold salute, whereas the Londoner made a free allusion to Polly, almost got his teeth knocked down his throat. Jack may not be happy about it, but seems he's on board with the madam's plan to marry off her daughter to a reasonably well-off suitor. I got the impression that maybe Duran wasn't the first boarder that was involved with Polly, but maybe the first one that the madam saw fit to entrap." G.K. Hahn said the mother, Mrs. Mooney, had quite a plan in mind. She wants to get her daughter off her hands, and by simply not interfering, or rather by delaying her eventual interference, she's probably succeeded. Mr. Duran obviously does not want to settle, however, I believe he will eventually marry Polly, with the societal pressure and for honour's sake. She can make him happy by bringing him food, I guess. That's sort of what he reduced their future marriage to in terms of their source of happiness. Tekrific said the subtle complicity between mother and daughter was quite fascinating. Also, the psychology in Polly, where she still pretends for her mother that she isn't as wise in the ways of the world that she really is. And the mother keeps up appearances for her daughter too, yet they both know and acquiesce quietly and inwardly. I've just noticed, she's pregnant, isn't she? Like, the daughter's pregnant, and that's what they're talking about. It's not just that they've caught them hooking up. That was my interpretation, although no one's really seemed to have mentioned pregnancy yet, have they? Or have they? Maybe they haven't. Yeah, I thought the daughter was pregnant, and that was why they were forced to get married. Right, and so the reason the mother held off was waiting for her to get knocked up so that the guy would be forced to marry her. It's not just that he's slept with her, it's that she's knocked up. Is that right? Is that what I'm to interpret from this story? There was also some comment in the story at some point which made it, when she was sort of thinking about the different options that she had as a mother, in how they can deal with it, how her daughter should deal with this situation. And there was something that was like an allusion to abortion, or like hinting at it, almost like a euphemism, I thought, but maybe I'm wrong. This was the line. There must be a reparation made in such a case. It is all very well for the man. He can go his way as if nothing had happened, having had his moment of pleasure. But the girl has to bear the brunt. Some mothers would be content to patch up such an affair for a sum of money. She had known cases of it. But she would not do so. For her, only reparation could make up for the loss of her daughter's honour, marriage. Right? So throw a little money at the problem, make it go away, but she's morally beyond that. They're talking about her being pregnant, right? Yeah. Now I'm not sure if I made up that whole thing about her being pregnant. I could be completely wrong. Doesn't matter. Anyway, Wasm said, "With this one story, we get a look at how Dublin's religion and society, everyone knowing each other, affects the lives of its people. How others see you is especially important. I wonder if there's also supposed to be alluding to how marriages were done for status or money rather than love." Cutilli came in with some interesting facts about writers. Unrelated to this particular story, but Cutilli is reading both Dubliners and Les Miserables. It says, "I found out a tragic similarity in the lives of Joyce and Hugo. They both had daughters who suffered from schizophrenia. Jung treated Joyce's daughter Lucia and had this to say about them. Like two people going to the bottom of a river, one falling and the other diving." Another interesting fact, Hemingway was so astonished after reading Joyce's masterpiece Ulysses that he smuggled a few copies of the then-banned novel into the US. I didn't know that Ulysses was ever banned in the US. I don't really understand why it was, but that's really interesting. Swim said the mama fishy said, "What got into Joyce? I swear this story could not have been more straightforward. It can be said the mother is basically pimping out her daughter for an advantageous marriage. The boarders call her the madam, and her boarding house was getting a poor reputation. She has a daughter entertaining the boarders who is in the habit of singing I'm a Naughty Girl. I had no doubt this formidable mama would bring the boarder up to scratch. Of course, it wouldn't be Joyce if there wasn't bleakness. It's obvious to me that love isn't involved in this transaction. If the boarder wants to keep his cushy job, he has to marry. I'm pretty sure the priest made that clear in the confessional. His professional standing will fall since he is marrying this lower-class girl. He's already mourning that loss." The girl acts all flustered, but once the boarder leaves to talk to her mum, she falls back on his bed, very comfortably. There was no longer any perturbation visible on her face. She waited on patiently, almost cheerfully, without alarm, her memory gradually giving place to hopes and visions of the future. I think the future bleakness for the daughter is foreshadowed. The mother married her father's foreman and they opened a butcher's shop. Did the father finagle all this? I think so. Her life went to hell, and so will the daughter's. And regarding question 3, if you're going to work for a Catholic wine operation, you want to get ahead, you better walk the talk. Ex-Pubilis X said, "So is this happy a story from Dublin as we can get? Really, in comparison, it's not bad at all. I mean, it's hardly unusual, or especially depraved. Some 35-year-old guy has to propose to a 19-year-old girl, and they both evidently at least find each other attractive. Nothing wrong with settling down at 35 anyway, even if it is something of a shotgun wedding. The girl seems too happy about it. She clearly wanted this guy to begin with. And he doesn't seem to be an abusive drunk, and she appears to want to take care of him too. Maybe it's not the ideal circumstances, but they have a real shot at being happy." I like your optimism, Ex-Pubilis X. And yeah, I agree. It's not the saddest story in the world. Well, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? It's not a tragedy. It's not ideal, but yeah. They made their bed. They can lie in it. Alright, so today's story is A Little Cloud. Story number, what are we up to? 8. And I think it's, well, I don't know if it's the longest one in this book, but it is a long one, 19 pages. So let's get into it. A Little Cloud from Dubliners by James Joyce. 8 years before he had seen his friend off at the North Wall and wished him godspeed, Gallagher had got on. You could tell that at once by his travelled air, his well-cut tweed suit and fearless accent. Few fellows had talents like his, and fewer still could remain unspoiled by such success. Gallagher's heart was in the right place, and he had deserved to win. It was something to have a friend like that. Little Chandler's thoughts ever since lunchtime had been of his meeting with Gallagher, and of Gallagher's invitation, and of the great city, London, where Gallagher lived. He was called Little Chandler because, though he was but slightly under the average stature, he gave one the idea of being a little man. His hands were white and small, his frame was fragile, his voice was quiet, and his manners were refined. He took the greatest care of his fair silken hair and moustache, and used perfume discreetly on his handkerchief. The half-moons of his nails were perfect, and when he smiled, you caught a glimpse of a row of childish white teeth. As he sat at his desk in the King's Inn, he thought what changes those 8 years had brought. The friend, whom he had known under a shabby and necessitous guise, had become a brilliant figure on the London press. He turned often from his tiresome writing to gaze out of the office window. The glow of a late autumn sunset covered the grass plots and walks. It cast a shower of kindly golden dust on the untidy nurses and decrepit old men who drowsed on the benches. It flickered upon all the moving figures, on the children who ran screaming along the gravel paths and on everyone who passed through the gardens. He watched the scene and thought of life, and as always happened, when he thought of life, he became sad. A gentle melancholy took possession of him. He felt how useless it was to struggle against fortune, this being the burden of wisdom which the ages had bequeathed to him. He remembered the books of poetry upon his shelves at home. He had bought them in his bachelor days, and many an evening, as he sat in the little room off the hall, he had been tempted to take one down from the bookshelf and read out something to his wife. But shyness had always held him back, and so the books had remained on their shelves. At times he repeated lines to himself, and this consoled him. When his hour had struck, he stood up and took leave of his desk and of his fellow clerks punctiliously. He emerged from under the feudal arch of the King's Inns, a neat, modest figure, and walked swiftly down Henrietta Street. The golden sunset was waning, and the air had grown sharp. A horde of grimy children populated the street. They stood or ran in the roadway and crawled up the steps before the gaping doors, or squatted like mice upon the thresholds. Little Chandler gave them no thought. He picked his way deftly through all that minute vermin-like life, and under the shadow of the gaunt spectral mansions in which the old nobility of Dublin had roistered, no memory of the past touched him, for his mind was full of a present joy. He had never been in Corliss's, but he knew the value of the name. He knew that people went there after the theatre to eat oysters and drink liquors, and he had heard that the waiters there spoke French and German. Walking swiftly by at night, he had seen cabs drawn up before the door, and richly dressed ladies, escorted by cavaliers, alight and enter quickly. They were noisy dresses and many wraps. Their faces were powdered, and they caught up their dresses when they touched earth like alarmed Atlantis. He had always passed without turning his head to look. It was his habit to walk swiftly in the street, even by day, and whenever he found himself in the city late at night, he hurried on his way apprehensively and excitedly. Sometimes, however, he courted the cases of his fear. He chose the darkest and narrowest streets, and as he walked boldly forward, the silence that was spread about his footsteps troubled him. The wandering silent figures troubled him, and at times a sound of low fugitive laughter made him tremble like a leaf. He turned to the right towards Capel Street, Ignatius Gallagher on the London Press. Who would have thought it possible 8 years before? Still, now that he reviewed the past, little Chandler could remember many signs of the future greatness in his friend. People used to say that Ignatius Gallagher was wild. Of course, he did mix with a rakish set of fellows at that time, drank freely, and got borrowed money on all sides. In the end, he had got mixed up in some shady affair, some money transaction. At least, that was one version of his flight. But nobody denied him talent. There was always a certain something in Ignatius Gallagher that impressed you in spite of yourself. Even when he was out at elbows and at his wit's end for money, he kept up a bold face. Little Chandler remembered, and the remembrance brought a slight flush of pride to his cheeks, that one of Ignatius Gallagher's sayings when he was in a tight corner, "Half time now, boys," he used to say lightheartedly, "where's my considering cap?" That was Ignatius Gallagher all out, and damn it if you couldn't but admire him for it. Little Chandler quickened his pace, for the first time in his life, he felt himself superior to the people he passed. For the first time his soul revolted against the dull inelegance of Capel Street. There was no doubt about it, if you wanted to succeed you had to go away. You could do nothing in Dublin. As he crossed Grattan Bridge, he looked down the river towards the lower quays and pitied the poor stunted houses. They seemed to him a band of tramps huddled together along the riverbanks, their old coats covered with dust and soot, stupefied by the panorama of sunset and waiting for the first chill of night. Bid them arise, shake themselves, and be gone. He wondered whether he could write a poem to express his idea. Perhaps Gallagher might be able to get it into some London paper for him. Could he write something original? He was not sure what idea he wished to express, but the thought that a poetic moment had touched him took life within him in an infant hope. He stepped onward bravely. Every step brought him nearer to London, farther from his own sober and artistic life. A light began to tremble on the horizon of his mind. He was not so old, 32. His temperament might be said to be just at the point of maturity. There were so many different moods and impressions that he wished to express in verse. He felt them within him. He tried to weigh his soul to see if it was a poet's soul. Melancholy was the dominant note of his temperament, he thought, but it was a melancholy tempered by recurrences of faith and resignation and simple joy. If he could give expression to it in a book of poems, perhaps men would listen. He would never be popular, he saw that. He could not sway the crowd, but he might appeal to a little circle of kindred minds. The English critics, perhaps, would recognize him as one of the Celtic school by reason of the melancholy tone of his poems. Beside that, he would put in allusions. He began to invent sentences and phrases from the notice which his book would get. Mr. Chandler has the gift of easy and graceful verse. Wistful sadness pervades these poems. The Celtic note. It was a pity his name was not more Irish-looking. Perhaps it would be better to insert his mother's name before the surname, Thomas Malone Chandler, or, better still, T. Malone Chandler. He would speak to Gallagher about it. He pursued his reverie so ardently that he passed his street and had to turn back. As he came near Corliss's, his former agitation began to overmaster him, and he halted before the door in indecision. Finally, he opened the door and entered. The light and noise of the bar held him at the doorways for a few moments. He looked about him, but his sight was confused by the shining of many red and green wine glasses. The bar seemed to him to be full of people, and he felt that the people were observing him curiously. He glanced quickly to the right and left, frowning slightly, to make his errand appear serious. But when his sight cleared a little, he saw that nobody had turned to look at him. And there, sure enough, was Ignatius Gallagher, leaning with his back against the counter and his feet planted far apart. "Hello, Tommy, old hero, here you are. What is it to be? What will you have? I'm taking whiskey, better stuff than we get across the water. Soda? Lithia? No mineral. I'm the same. Spoils the flavour. Here, garçon, bring us 2 halves of malt whiskey, like a good fellow. Well, and how have you been pulling along since I saw you last? Dear God, how old we're getting. Do you see any signs of ageing in me? Hey, what? A little grey and thin on the top. What? Ignatius Gallagher took off his hat and displayed a large, closely cropped head. His face was heavy, pale and clean-shaven. His eyes, which were of bluish slate colour, relieved his unhealthy pallor, and shone out plainly above the vivid orange tie he wore. Between these rival features the lips appeared very long and shapeless and colourless. He bent his head and felt with 2 sympathetic fingers the thin hair at the crown. Little Chandler shook his head as a denial. Ignatius Gallagher put on his hat again. "It pulls you down," he said. "Press life. Always hurry and scurry, looking for copy and sometimes not finding it, and then always to have something new in your stuff. Damn proofs and printers, I say, for a few days. I'm deuced glad, I can tell you, to get back to the old country. Does a fellow good a bit of a holiday? I feel a ton better since I landed again in dear dirty Dublin. Here you are, Tommy. Water? Say when." Little Chandler allowed his whiskey to be very much diluted. "You don't know what's good for you, my boy," said Ignatius Gallagher. "I drink mine neat." I drink very little as a rule, said little Chandler modestly. An odd half one or so when I meet any of the old crowd, that's all. Ah, well, said Ignatius Gallagher cheerfully, here's to us and to old times and old acquaintance. They clinked glasses and drank the toast. I met some of the old gang today, said Ignatius Gallagher. O'Hara seems to be in a bad way. What's he doing?
Nothing, said little Chandler.
He's gone to the dogs.
But Hogan has a good sit, hasn't he?
Yes, he's in the Land Commission. I met him one night in London and he seemed to be very flush.
Poor O'Hara. Booze, I suppose.
Other things too, said little Chandler shortly. Ignatius Gallagher laughed. Tommy, he said, I see you haven't changed an atom. You're the very same serious person that used to lecture me on Sunday mornings when I had a sore head and a fur on my tongue. You'd want to knock about a bit in the world. Have you never been anywhere, even for a trip?
I've been to the Isle of Man, said little Chandler.
Ignatius Gallagher laughed. The Isle of Man, he said. Go to London or Paris. Paris for choice. That'd do you good.
Have you seen Paris?
I should think I have. I've knocked about there a little.
And is it really so beautiful as they say? Asked little Chandler.
He sipped a little of his drink while Ignatius Gallagher finished his boldly.
Beautiful, said Ignatius Gallagher, pausing on the word and on the flavour of his drink.
It's not so beautiful, you know, of course. It is beautiful, but it's the life of Paris. That's the thing. Ah, there's no city like Paris for gaiety, movement, excitement.
Little Chandler finished his whiskey and, after some trouble, succeeded in catching the barman's eye. He ordered the same again.
I've been to the Moulin Rouge, Ignatius Gallagher continued when the barman had removed their glasses, and I've been to all the bohemian cafes. Hot stuff. Not for a pious chap like you, Tommy.
Little Chandler said nothing until the barman returned with two glasses. Then he touched his friend's glass lightly and reciprocated the former toast. He was beginning to feel somewhat disillusioned. Gallagher's accent and way of expressing himself did not please him. There was something vulgar in his friend, which he had not observed before. But perhaps it was only the result of living in London amid the bustle and competition of the press. The old personal charm was still there under this new gaudy manner. And after all Gallagher had lived, he had seen the world, little Chandler looked at his friend enviously.
Everything in Paris is gay, said Ignatius Gallagher. They believe in enjoying life, and don't you think they're right? If you want to enjoy yourself properly, you must go to Paris. And, mind you, they have a great feeling for the Irish there. When they heard I was from Ireland, they were ready to eat me, man.
Little Chandler took four or five sips from his glass. Tell me, he said, is it true that Paris is so immoral, as they say?
Ignatius Gallagher made a Catholic gesture with his right arm.
Every place is immoral, he said. Of course, you do find spicy bits in Paris. Go to one of the students' balls, for instance. That's lively, if you like, when the coquettes begin to let themselves loose. You know what they are, I suppose.
I've heard of them, said little Chandler.
Ignatius Gallagher drank off his whiskey and shook his hand.
Ah, he said, you may say what you like. There's no woman like a Parisian for style, for go.
Then it is an immoral city, said little Chandler, with timid insistence. I mean, compared with London or Dublin.
London? Said Ignatius Gallagher. It's six of one and half a dozen of the other. You ask Hogan, my boy. I showed him a bit about London when he was over there.
He'd open your eye, I say, Tommy. Don't make punch of that whiskey. Liquor up.
No, really.
Oh, come on, another one won't do you any harm. What is it? The same again, I suppose?
Well, all right.
Francois, the same again. Will you smoke, Tommy?
Ignatius Gallagher produced his cigar case. The two friends lit their cigars and puffed at them in silence until their drinks were served.
I'll tell you my opinion, said Ignatius Gallagher, emerging after some time from the clouds of smoke in which he had taken refuge. It's a rum world. Talk of immortality. I've heard of cases. What am I saying? I've known them. Cases of immortality. Ignatius Gallagher puffed thoughtfully at his cigar, and then, in a calm historian's tone, he proceeded to sketch for his friend some pictures of the corruption, which was rife abroad. He summarized the vices of many capitals, and seemed inclined to award the palm to Berlin. Some things he would not vouch for, his friends had told him, but others he had had personal experience. He spared neither rank nor caste. He revealed many of the secrets of religious houses on the continent, and described some of the practices which were fashionable in high society, and ended by telling, with details, a story about an English duchess, a story which he knew to be true. Little Chandler was astonished. "Oh, well," said Ignatius Gallagher, "here we are in old Jog, along Dublin, where nothing is known of such things." "How dull you must find it," said little Chandler, "after all the places you've seen." "Well," said Ignatius Gallagher, "it's a relaxation to come over here, you know. And after all, it's the old country, as they say, isn't it? You can't help having a certain feeling for it. That's human nature. But tell me something about yourself. Hogan told me you had tasted the joys of connubial bliss 2 years ago, wasn't it?" Little Chandler blushed and smiled. "Yes," he said, "I was married last May, 12 months. "I hope it's not too late in the day to offer my best wishes," said Ignatius Gallagher. "I didn't know your address, or I'd have done so at the time." He extended his hand, which little Chandler took. "Well, Tommy," he said, "I wish you and yours every joy in life, old chap, and tons of money, and may you never die till I shoot you." "And that's the wish of a sincere friend, an old friend. You know that." "I know that," said little Chandler. "Any youngsters?" said Ignatius Gallagher. Little Chandler blushed again. "We have one child," he said. "Son or daughter?" "Little boy." Ignatius Gallagher slapped his friend sonorously on the back. "Bravo," he said. "I wouldn't doubt you, Tommy." Little Chandler smiled, looked confusedly at his glass, and bit his lower lip with 3 childishly white front teeth. "I hope you'll spend an evening with us," he said, "before you go back. My wife will be delighted to meet you. We can have a little music and..." "Thanks awfully, old chap," said Ignatius Gallagher. "I'm sorry we didn't meet earlier, but I must leave tomorrow night."
"Tonight, perhaps?"
"Ah, I'm awfully sorry, old man. You see, I'm over here with another fellow. Clever young chap he is, too, and we arranged to go to a little card party. Only for that..."
"Oh, in that case..."
"But who knows," said Ignatius Gallagher considerately. "Next year I may take a little skip over here now that I've broken the ice. It's only a pleasure deferred."
"Very well," said little Chandler. "And the next time you come we must have an evening together. That's agreed now, isn't it?"
"Yes, agreed," said Ignatius Gallagher.
"Next year, if I come, parole d'honneur."
"And the clinch... And to clinch the bargain," said little Chandler, "we'll just have one more now." Ignatius Gallagher took out a large gold watch and looked at it.
"Is it to be the last?" he said, "because, you know, I have an AP.
"Oh, yes, positively," said little Chandler.
"Very well, then," said Ignatius Gallagher, "let us have another one as a doc and dory. That's good vernacular for a small whiskey, I believe."
Little Chandler ordered the drinks. The blush, which had risen to his face a few moments before, was establishing itself. A trifle made him blush at any time, and now he felt warm and excited. 3 small whiskies had gone to his head, and Gallagher's strong cigar had confused his mind, for he was a delicate and abstinent person. The adventure of meeting Gallagher, after 8 years of finding himself with Gallagher in Corliss's, surrounded by lights and noise, of listening to Gallagher's stories, and of sharing, for a brief space, Gallagher's vagrant and triumphant life, upset the equipoise of his sensitive nature. He felt acutely the contrast between his own life and his friend's, and it seemed to him unjust. Gallagher was his inferior in birth and education. He was sure that he could do something better than his friend had ever done, or could ever do, something higher than mere tawdry journalism if he only got the chance. What was it that stood in his way? His unfortunate timidity. He wished to vindicate himself in some way, to assert his manhood. He saw behind Gallagher's refusal of his invitation. Gallagher was only patronizing him by his friendliness, just as he was patronizing Ireland by his visit. The barman brought their drinks. Little Chandler pushed one glass towards his friend and took up the other boldly. "Who knows," he said as they lifted their glasses. "When you come next year, I may have the pleasure of wishing long life and happiness to Mr. and Mrs. Ignatius Gallagher." Ignatius Gallagher, in the act of drinking, closed one eye expressively over the rim of his glass. When he had drunk, he smacked his lips decisively, set down his glass, and said, "No bloomin' fear of that, my boy. I'm going to have my fling first and see a bit of life and the world before I put my head in the sack, if I ever do." "Some day you will," said little Chandler calmly. Ignatius Gallagher turned his orange tie and slate-blue eyes full upon his friend. "You think so?" he said. "You'll put your head in the sack," repeated little Chandler stoutly, "like everyone else, if you can find the girl." He had slightly emphasized his tone, and he was aware that he had betrayed himself, but though the color had heightened in his cheek, he did not flinch from his friend's gaze. Ignatius Gallagher watched him for a few moments and then said, "If ever it occurs, you may bet your bottom dollar there'll be no mooning and spooning about it. I mean to marry money. She'll have a good fat account at the bank, or she won't do for me." Little Chandler shook his head. "Why, man alive," said Ignatius Gallagher vehemently, "do you know what it is? I've only to say the word, and tomorrow I can have the woman and the cash. You don't believe it? Well, I know it. There are hundreds, what am I saying, thousands of rich Germans and Jews, rotten with money, that'd only be too glad. You wait a while, my boy, see if I don't play my cards properly. When I go about a thing, I mean business, I tell you. You just wait." He tossed his glass to his mouth, finished his drink, and laughed loudly. Then he looked thoughtfully before him and said in a calmer tone, "But I'm in no hurry. They can wait. I don't fancy tying myself up to one woman, you know." He imitated with his mouth the act of tasting and made a wry face. "Must get a bit stale, I should think," he said. Little Chandler sat in the room of the hall holding a child in his arms. To save money, they kept no servant, but Annie's young sister Monica came for an hour or so in the morning and then an hour or so in the evening to help. But Monica had gone home long ago. It was 9:15. Little Chandler had come home late for tea, and moreover he had forgotten to bring Annie home the parcel of coffee from Booley's. Of course, she was in a bad humour and gave him short answers. She said she would do without any tea, but when it came near the time at which the shop at the corner closed, she decided to go out herself for 1/4 pound of tea and 2 pounds of sugar. She put the sleeping child deftly in his arms and said, "Here, don't waken him." A little lamp with a white china shade stood upon the table, and its light fell over the photograph, which was enclosed in a frame of crumpled horn. It was Annie's photograph. Little Chandler looked at it, pausing at the thin, tight lips. She wore the pale blue summer blouse which he had brought her home as a present one Saturday. It had cost him 10 and 11 pence, but what an agony of nervousness it had cost him. How he had suffered that day, waiting at the corner door until the shop was empty, standing at the counter and trying to appear at his ease while the girl piled ladies' blouses before him, paying at the desk and forgetting to take up the odd penny of his change, being called back by the cashier and finally striving to hide his blushes as he left the shop by examining the parcel to see if it was secured tied. When he brought the blouse home, Annie kissed him and said it was very pretty and stylish, but when she heard the price, she threw the blouse on the table and said it was a regular swindle to charge 10 and 11 pence for it. At first, she wanted to take it back, but when she tried it on, she was delighted with it, especially with the make of the sleeves, and kissed him and said he was very good to think of her. He looked coldly into the eyes of the photograph, and they answered coldly, Certainly they were pretty, and the face itself was pretty, but he found something mean in it. Why was it so unconscious and ladylike? The composure of the eyes irritated him. They repelled him and defied him. There was no passion in them, no rapture. He thought of what Galahad had said about rich Jewesses, those dark oriental eyes. He thought how full they are of passion, of voluptuous longing. Why had he married the eyes in the photograph? He caught himself up at the question and glanced nervously around the room. He found something mean in the pretty furniture which he had bought for his house on the hire system. Annie had chosen it herself, and it reminded him of her. It was too prim and pretty. A dull resentment against his life awoke within him. Could he not escape from his little house? Was it too late for him to try to live bravely like Gallagher? Could he go to London? There was the furniture still to be paid for. If he could only write a book and get it published, that might open the way for him. A volume of Byron's poems lay before him on the table. He opened it cautiously with his left hand, lest he should waken the child, and began to read the first poem in the book. Hushed are the winds, and still the evening gloom. Not even a zephyr wanders through the grove. Whilst I return to view my Margaret's tomb and scatter flowers on the dust I love. He paused. He felt the rhythm of the verse about him in the room. How melancholy it was. Could he too write like that, express the melancholy of his soul in verse? There were so many things he wanted to describe. His sensation of a few hours before on Grattan Bridge, for example. If he could get back again into that mood. The child awoke and began to cry. He turned from the page and tried to hush it, but it would not be hushed. He began to rock it to and fro in his arms, and it began wailing, crying, growing keener. He rocked it faster while his eyes began to read the second stanza. Within the narrow cell reclines her clay, that clay where once... It was useless. He couldn't read. He couldn't do anything. The wailing of the child pierced the drum of his ear. It was useless, useless. He was a prisoner for life. His arms trembled with anger, and suddenly, bending to the child's face, he shouted, "Stop!" The child stopped for an instant, had a spasm of fright, and began to scream. He jumped up from his chair and walked hastily up and down the room with the child in his arms. It began to sob piteously, losing its breath and for four or five seconds, and then bursting out anew. The thin walls of the room echoed the sound. He tried to soothe it, but it sobbed more convulsively. He looked at the contracted and quivering face of the child and began to be alarmed. He counted 7 sobs without a break between them and caught the child to his breast in fright. If it died... The door was burst open and a young woman ran in, panting. "What is it? What is it?" she cried. The child, hearing its mother's voice, broke out into a paroxysm of sobbing. "It's nothing, Annie, it's nothing," he began to cry. She flung her parcels on the floor and snatched the child from him. "What have you done to him?" she cried, glaring into his face. Little Chandler sustained for one moment the gaze of her eyes, and his heart closed together as he met the hatred in them. He began to stammer. "It's nothing, he began to cry. I didn't do anything. What?" Giving no heed to him, she began to walk up and down the room, clasping the child tightly in her arms and murmuring, "My little man, my little Manny, was you frightened, love? There now, love, there now, lumberborn, mamma's little lamb of the world, there now." Little Chandler felt his cheeks suffused with shame, and he stood back out of the lamplight. He listened while the paroxysm of the child's sobbing grew less and less, and tears of remorse started to his eyes. All right, there we go. Another story from Dublin is down. A long one, but hey, I quite like that one as well. That one was called, let me scroll back up again, was it A Little Cloud, I think it was. Yeah, that's right. A Little Cloud. Can't find it. Yeah, A Little Cloud. Very cool. All right, have your say about this short story at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. And I look forward to reading the discussion around this chapter. A reminder, coming up in, about 10 days or so from now, we will be starting the next book, Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. So get your copies of that ready. It's not too late to get the official The Hemingway List copy, paperback copy. So go to Amazon.com, type in The Hemingway List, and you should be able to find the Emily Bronte Wuthering Heights book. Or you can, you know, grab any edition of that book. That will suffice as well. Also, I've got the Patreon page up and running still. Big thanks to my Patreon supporters. Helps me spend the time necessary to make this podcast every day. If you enjoy listening and participating in this project, do consider becoming a Patreon subscriber. You can subscribe for as little as $1 per month, or you can sort of just choose whatever value you think matches to, you know, what you get out of this podcast. So thank you very much for considering that. That's at patreon.com/thehemingwaylist if you're interested. Other than that, that's going to do us. Thanks very much for listening tonight, and I will see you tomorrow.